So first of all, good evening. I'm going to stand, if that's okay, if that doesn't make you feel uncomfortable, but hard for me to sit and talk at the same time. I want to thank the Colemans.
Do you want me to move the chair? You'll have more room to walk around.
I'm fine.
Okay.
And thank the Rothschilds also for being our partners in this series, and thank all of you for participating. We really have made an effort this year to listen and to begin to service the needs of the broader community in terms of what our Beit Midrash is offering, and try to create a certain dynamism in terms of the learning that's happening here in our community. So we appreciate your attendance. We also appreciate your feedback in terms of ideas going forward for what we can do to make sure that we're all challenging ourselves, challenging our ideas, and growing as learners within Torah and learners about the Torah community. So for the next 3 weeks, we are taking a slight detour from the series that we've done, been doing with Rabbi Sinensky, to take a sort of a glance historically at the making of what I'm referring to as modern Judaism. My dissertation advisor, a man by the name of Professor Jay Harris, who's currently the undergraduate dean at Harvard, once was asked why it is that he, and I in his footsteps, like to focus on modern Jewish history up until and through the 19th century, but generally staying away from the 20th. And he responded that the big difference between the 19th century and the 20th is that, for the most part, those who lived in the 19th century are now dead. And the difference between people who are alive and people who are dead is that you can talk about dead people and they can't talk back. There are many other good reasons for focusing on the 19th century, although the 20th century is filled with interesting history as well. The history of the Jewish world in the 19th century really is the beginnings of the contemporary Jewish world that we know of today. So much happened in the course of really what amounts to 75 years, if not less, that shaped the course of our Jewish community in ways that we still very much recognize and in ways that we still live and breathe to this day. So our focus over the next 3 weeks is going to be on the makings of three different, for lack of a better word, denominations within the Jewish world. This week we're going to focus on the rise of the Reform Movement. Next week we're going to look at the rise of what is known as the Ultra-Orthodox Movement. And then in our last of our three, we will be looking at the rise of what is known as the Neo-Orthodox community, which is the precursor to the modern Orthodox community. So, our story begins in the early 19th century. In a small Prussian town known as Seesen, in what was then the province of Westphalia.
Westphalia?
Close, but not exactly the same. Now, before you start looking at these sheets, I want you to do something. I want you to do a little intellectual exercise for a minute. I want you to close your eyes for a moment and imagine what does an Eastern European shul look like 16th century, 17th century. What are we imagining? What does it look like?
Same as today, but without the electricity.
No.
What do you think?
Big wooden structure.
Right.
Big wooden structure. Okay. What are we finding inside?
Galleries for the women.
Balconies. Not in Eastern Europe so much, but certainly in Central Europe you would. If there weren't balconies, they were in the back of the room, right? Generally with an actual wall, right, separating the two. Good. What does the inside look like?
Rustic.
Huh?
Rustic.
Rustic.
Very basic.
Okay. Very basic. Absolutely. Okay.
Pews, not standards.
Generally speaking, right? All right, good. What does the davening sound like?
Disorganized.
Mumbling.
Okay. All right, it's quick, right? There's, well, perhaps, depends on where you were. What is the pronunciation that they're using?
Ashkenaz.
It sounds very much like the Yiddish that is their vernacular. Okay, good. So, bring you back now to 1810. It's the town of Seeson. We're going to read a contemporary account of the opening of the shul. New shul in this town of Seeson. We're going to read an account of the ceremony in which it was opened, and then the speech from the man responsible for opening, his dedication speech at the top of the next page. As we read through it, I want you to note, what is it about this that looks and sounds different? What is unexpected about this description compared to the mental image we just drew of what we imagined a traditional European shul looks like in the 17th, 16th, 15th centuries, and we're now at the beginning of the 19th. In solemn silence, the long procession went from the auditorium of the school into the halls, through the doors into the street, and again through the doors of another house, and through this house into the court to the temple. The temple that they're referring to is a temple, a shul that is being built as an extension of a school. A school founded by this man, Israel Jacobson. I believe he started the school in 1803. This is now 1810. The school had grown. It may have been 1806. The school had grown, and now they needed a proper place in which for the boys in this school to daven, and they were now going to open this to the larger community as well. So if you actually look at the picture at the bottom, the building on the left is the school building. And so the procession starts there, it goes outside to the building that is closer, that is the new shul that they are now dedicating. After the procession had entered the temple proper, there came from the organ loft lovely music by 60 to 70 musicians and singers. And this put all hearts into the most solemn mood. And after everyone had taken his seat, a cantata, composed especially for the celebration by Dr. Heinroth, one of the teachers in the Jacobson Institute, that's the school, was sung splendidly to the accompaniment of the rousing sound of the instruments. The Jewish ritual now began, with Mr. Jacobson himself being the chief officiant and the rabbis assisting him. At the end, President Jacobson gave an address, which we bring further on in excerpt. After the scrolls of the Torah, which were elaborately ornamented, had been taken from the ark with great ceremony, they were carried around the temple seven times, preceded by boys with burning wax candles. Then several chapters of the Pentateuch, the Chumash, were read, first in Hebrew and at once in German, publicly with a loud voice. Mr. Schott, director of the educational institution, then mounted the rostrum and talked to the assembled multitude. Then came a chorale accompanied by organ and full orchestra, and this was sung first in Hebrew and also in German. At the end of this song, in the singing of which the Christians and Israelites participated with deep emotion, Church Councillor Heinemann delivered an address befitting the occasion. After this address, there were further songs by the choir.
Where about in Poland, though? Right?
No, we're talking Germany now. We're talking Germany, right? What strikes you as...
Can we assume that this is not Shabbat?
This is not Shabbat. Correct. It's not Shabbat. Say it again.
It sounds like church.
It sounds like church. Why? What about it?
They read from Hebrew and in German, they sing with organs, a choir.
Okay, choirs, organs,
processionals,
candles, translations into German. Good, anything else?
Are there non-Jews there?
There are non-Jews there. Yeah. Okay, good. Anything else? What is this description emphasizing? What is it about this procession that was so moving, this person who was writing it?
The pomp and circumstance.
Exactly. The pomp, circumstance, the decorum, the right, the way in which it's been organized and put together, right, is of tremendous importance, right, to this writer. Absolutely. Okay. Let's listen to what Mr. Jacobson says in his dedication address. I'm just giving you a selection of a selection. And that's a picture of him, by the way, there on the left. Be it far from me that I should have any secret intention to undermine the pillars of your faith, to diminish our old and honored principles through the glitter of new opinions, or that because of some hidden vanity I should become a traitor to both our religion and, I should say, you, or yours. You know my faithful adherence to the faith of my fathers. I need not protest it. My actions will witness for me more than my words. But if I do seek here some rapprochement between you and our Christian neighbors, I would ask more for your gratitude and honest help than for your criticism or even opposition. For your true and progressive enlightenment depends upon this rapprochement. On it depends the education of your spirit for true religiosity and, at the same time also, your future greater political welfare. Let me read that again. On it depends the education of your spirit for true religiosity and, at the same time also, your future greater political welfare. Who would dare to deny that our service is sickly because of many useless things, that in part it has degenerated into a thoughtless recitation of prayers and formula, that it kills decision more than encourages it, and that it limits our religious principles to that fund of knowledge which for centuries has remained in our treasure houses without increase and without ennoblement. On all sides, enlightenment opens up new areas for development. Why should we alone remain behind? The temple in Seisen opened by Israel Jacobson in 1810 is largely regarded by historians as the first Reform temple. The question is, how did we get there? How did we go from that image that we all drew for ourselves? Now, the suggestion was made is, oh, this is Germany, that feels better. Well, Germany in 1780 didn't look, German Jewry did not look terribly different than Jewry in Volozhin or Minsk, right, or in the Carpathian Mountains, right, Munkacs. In fact, we know rabbis often went back and forth, right? The rabbi in Volozhin was the rabbi in Altona and Hamburg, right? The language was Yiddish. The community did not look terribly different. Now, there were different things happening outside the community, for sure, right? And that's what we need to talk about right now, and that will help us to understand how by 1810 we have the opening of something, you're right, we would never find, right, in Munkacs or Lvov, right, or Minsk or Volozhin, right, but in Seisen and Westphalia, in what will later become Germany, we do. So what happened? So the story really begins, like I said before, outside the world of the Jewish community. And it begins with a two-century process in the 17th and 18th century in Germany and France, known as the European Enlightenment. The European Enlightenment is an intellectual revolution of sorts in which thinkers begin to question everything. One of the great mottos of the Enlightenment is dare to think. Descartes, who was one of the great early Enlightenment thinkers, is famous for what phrase?
I think therefore I am.
I think therefore I am. What does that mean? Everybody knows the line.
If I'm to live, I'm not thinking I'm not an elitist.
Almost. Almost.
Think it till you make it. You can just think it and you are it.
No.
Proof for existence.
Huh?
It was a proof for existence.
Right.
Yes, it was. It was, yes. Descartes was going through a process in his own mind of questioning what it is he actually knows and what he doesn't know. What can he know without a shadow of a doubt? That was this process. And he's sitting in a bunker somewhere. He's a soldier, right? An infantryman who is going through, he's bored out of his mind, he's going through this process in his own head, right? Trying to figure out what does he know for sure and what could he be potentially being deceived. Right? Where could he be potentially being deceived? Right? So his senses, anything he knows because he senses it, it's easy to deceive the senses. Right? That's easy. That's not something he knows for sure. Right? So he has to do away with anything, right, that he knows because he has sensed it in one way or the other. And he goes through this entire process, and the culmination of which is that the only thing he knows for sure is that he's thinking. That something is thinking. That he knows for sure. And because something is thinking, therefore I, the thing that's doing the thinking, must exist. Okay? The point, though, is that this process of questioning, what do I know and what do I not know? How do I know it? Who told, is it, do I have proof? Do I have empirical evidence for something? Do I believe this because somebody told me I should believe it? Because it's what we've always done. Those are the things that come under attack in the Enlightenment. And what emerges from that are the things we take for granted in our world. It's science. And the separation of religion and science. It's philosophy and science. An enlightened world where all the technological and scientific breakthroughs that we encountered in the 20th century were a result of foundations that were laid during the time of the Enlightenment. So that process of Enlightenment clearly impacts the Jewish communities living in Western Europe at the same time. To the point where a small group of Jewish intellectuals who are still at this point not allowed to attend universities or in official organs of education, but nonetheless begin to read. They begin to take in what's happening around them, begin to process it, and even begin to produce. Who is the most famous Jewish Enlightenment thinker of the 18th century? Moses Mendelssohn. Moses Mendelssohn, an excellent philosopher, political philosopher, well-regarded within Jewish circles and outside of Jewish circles. But so a small group of Jewish intellectuals emerges by the end of the 18th century. Their world is a world of intellectual inquiry, of intellectual production that is deeply different than anything you would find in Poland. At the bottom of page 2, you have a selection from a wonderful autobiography. How many Jews in the 18th century left autobiographies, right? Solomon Maimon left us his. Now, as you'll see, he had a good reason for leaving it. He had quite a story. But Solomon Maimon came from a very traditional Polish family and makes his way to Western Europe in search of something, a more enlightened society of some sort, encounters a very different world in Western Europe, so much so that he simply can't see himself going back. So let's read a little bit of Maimon's description. He's describing 1787 and the difference between the two worlds that he had now encountered. "Meanwhile, my wife and eldest son arrived from Poland. A woman of rude education and manners, but of great good sense and the courage of an Amazon, she demanded that I should at once return home with her, not seeing the impossibility of what she required. I had now lived some years in Germany, had happily emancipated myself from the fetters of superstition and religious prejudice, had abandoned the rude manner of life in which I had been brought up, and extended my knowledge in many directions. I could not, therefore, return to my former barbarous and miserable condition, deprive myself of all the advantages I had gained, and expose myself to a rabbinical rage at the slightest deviation from the ceremonial law or the utterance of a liberal opinion. I represented to her that this could not be done at once, that I should require, first of all, to make my situation known to my friends here as well as in Berlin, and solicit from them the assistance of 200 or 300 thalers so that I might be able to live in Poland independent of my religious associates. But she would not. She would listen to nothing of all this, and declared her resolution to obtain a divorce, if I would not go with her immediately. Here, therefore, it was for me to choose the less of two evils, and I consented to the divorce." What is he describing? How is he talking about Poland and the world that he left behind? What's the difference between those two worlds?
He's basically saying religion is no longer relevant to him. He's found something that he replaced religion with something else that he thought was better, more enlightened.
Religion as a whole?
Autocratic.
Okay, the Polish religion of his upbringing, for sure. Right, he had found something. Now, the people that he was hanging out with in Western Europe were not opposed to religion. They weren't atheists. Mendelssohn was an observant Jew to the day of his death, right, for sure. So they weren't against religion, but what were the things about his religion, about what he associated with Poland, that really bothered him?
Superstition.
He saw it as superstitious, right? Small-minded, right? What else? What do you say about the rabbi?
Religious prejudice.
Okay, religious prejudice, the autocracy, the power of the rabbis. Right? Why did he need to raise money in order to go back?
He wanted to live away from the community.
He wanted to live away from his own community.
Okay, what would happen? What was the most powerful tool of the rabbinic establishment?
Cherem.
Cherem, right? Cherem would mean that nobody can do business with you, right? So it was hard to make a living at all if you didn't accord with the Rabbanim of the time. So again, by the 1780s, this is a small group. It's a small group of Jewish intellectuals in Western Europe who are beginning to carve out space for themselves where they're talking about these kinds of things, right? Mendelssohn, again, looming large over this group. But we begin to see the emergence of two very different cultures. So on the map that you have on page 3, this map begins to outline the major institutions that emerge that begin to identify with something that is known as a Jewish Enlightenment, or in Hebrew, Haskalah. Right? Now, not to be confused with the European Enlightenment. The European Enlightenment is pretty much over and done by 1789. Right? 1789 is what major world event? The French Revolution. The French Revolution really signifies the end of the Enlightenment, and the Jews are just getting started. Right? So Haskalah is a Jewish movement that really comes at the very end of the European Enlightenment, very much influenced by the European Enlightenment. But this map begins to show you where institutions, organizations begin to emerge that identify and associate with this Jewish, more enlightened approach to Judaism. And what I want to call your attention to is that the first institutions that really emerge are schools. They're schools, and generally the easiest way to establish an institution of this type was to establish what kind of school. What do you think? What do you think would rouse the least opposition in a community? A girl's school, that's a good guess. That's a good guess. Some of them will include education for girls, actually, interestingly. Right. The best way to do it is to offer a school for the poor or the orphans.
Oh.
Right? who's gonna oppose that? Right? You're willing to do it. You're willing to raise money for it and teach these kids who don't have, you know, another option. By all means, I'm not gonna start. I'm gonna start nitpicking on what curriculum you're gonna be teaching them. Right? Of course not. Right? So that's where these schools begin to take root. So if you look. The center of this movement is really Berlin. Right? So if you look at where it says Prussia, and you look up in sort of the northwest, you find Berlin. And out from Berlin begins to emerge in that vicinity. So if you look down at Dessau, Dessau in 1798 has a school that's established there. Dessau is home to, in rabbinic writing from the 18th century and early 19th century, you see Moses Mendelssohn is referred to as Reish Mem Dalet, right? Rav Moshe Midessau. So Mendelssohn was from Dessau. If you look down at Breslau, which is right underneath the word Prussia, so you see already in 1791 a school opens, in 1797 another school opens, in 1801 another school opens. And the other reason why the first institutions that opens are schools is because that also gives Parnassa to these intellectuals, right, who are, what else are they going to do? They're not opening general stores, right? They open schools. That's what they do, right? They think, they teach. So this is really where we begin to have the first institutional roots of this kind of approach, this approach to Jewish enlightenment. But something else very important is happening at the end of the 19th century, at the end of the 18th century. The story of the temple at Sisin is not just a story of a school, which Jacobson starts, which is exactly this kind of school. Jacobson starts a school in Sisin for underprivileged boys, right, that was going to have a more enlightened curriculum, and then eventually he opens a shul connected to it that is a more enlightened shul. But there's something else that important that's happening. I mentioned the French Revolution. Right? The French Revolution is an earthquake for the European world. It's an earthquake whose first tremors are actually not in Europe. They're where? Here, right? With the American Revolution. Right? The American Revolution is what ushers in, right, the first time that the ideas of the Enlightenment are materialized in a massive political movement. And then that is played out again in the French Revolution in Europe. But the French Revolution comes with it the concretizing of enlightened ideas about the rights of human beings. all human beings. Right? So that in 1789, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizens, passed by the National Constituent Assembly in August 1789, reads as follows. Men are born and remain free and equal in rights. Social distinctions can be founded only on the common good, on the top of page 4. Article 10 reads, no one may be disturbed for his opinions, even religious ones, provided that their manifestation does not trouble the public order established by the law. So what? What does this have to do with our story?
Because it includes Jews.
For the first time in the history of Europe. Right? For the first time in the history of Europe, Jews, by law in France, ought to have full rights. They should be able to own land. They should be able to go to court. They should be able to enter any profession they choose. They should be able to attend university. All things that were denied to Jews for centuries in Europe. All of a sudden, French Revolution, the rights of all men, and that which should ought to include Jews. So we discussed at our shir, those who were at our shir on Sukkot, we discussed the fact that it wasn't so simple. It seems simple, but yet a debate erupts. Following the Declaration of the Rights of Man as to whether Jews are really included in this. Right? Jews, and we remember the other two classes of people that they were unsure of whether they should include?
Gypsies.
No.
Catholics?
No. No. Jews, actors, and executioners. Yes, Jews, actors, and executioners, it was unclear as to whether they deserve the full rights granted by the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen. So, in a famous speech, Count Clermont-Tonnay argues for the inclusion of Jews into this declaration, but not in the way we might have imagined. Here's what he writes. But they say to me, the Jews have their own judges and laws. That is, how can we consider them to be citizens of France if they have their own laws? They have their own courts. That doesn't sound like a citizen of France. That sounds like a citizen of something else. So they say to me, the Jews have their own judges and laws. I respond that that is your fault, and you should not allow it. That is your fault. That is the French government. It is your fault, and you should not allow it. We must refuse everything to the Jews as a nation and accord everything to Jews as individuals. We must withdraw recognition from their judges. They should have only our judges. We must refuse legal protection to the maintenance of the so-called laws of their Judaic organization. They should not be allowed to form in the state either a political body or an order. They must be citizens individually. But some will say to me, they do not want to be citizens. Well then, if they do not want to be citizens, they should say so. And then we should banish them. It is repugnant to have in the state an association of non-citizens and a nation within a nation. In short, sirs, the presumed status of every man resident in a country is to be a citizen.
It's not an unreasonable position.
It's not an unreasonable
position. I mean, from their perspective, we don't want a nation within a nation. It's not anti-Semitic. It's not an unreasonable position.
Fair enough. Right? This idea of citizenship is actually what replaces the idea of religious belonging and identity in post-revolutionary Europe, post-French revolutionary Europe. It used to be to belong, you had to belong to a particular religious order of some sort. Now that the Enlightenment has done away with that, what emerges is this need to be a citizen. And if you can prove that you are deserving of citizenship, then in fact we grant you citizenship. So that is 1789. The emergence of the revolutionary government. If you know the story of France's revolution, doesn't turn out terribly well for them. By the 1790s, a influential general has accorded quite a bit of power for himself in France, and ultimately makes himself the emperor of France in 1804. And that was a man by the name of
Napoleon.
Now, Napoleon is what he considers to be an enlightened despot. Right? So yes, he's an autocrat. Yes, he's emperor. But the principles of his empire ought to be enlightened. And within that enlightened vision of his empire comes rights for all men, including Jews. Now, what does Napoleon do once he becomes emperor? He sets out to conquer
the rest of Europe.
Right? So, if you flip the page, so you see France. France, this is expanded France. Right? France under Napoleon was quite large. And that's the darker green. If you move eastward, you see the Confederation of the Rhine, and you see the various battles starting in 1805, and then 1806. He begins to move his way eastward. Ultimately, the Austrians decide not to fight him and ally with him instead. So by the time you get to 1807, Napoleon has conquered the vast majority of Europe up until Russia, and then he begins to focus his energy on the Iberian Peninsula and around Spain, so that by 1812, he has conquered the vast majority of Europe, and then he stages his famous invasion into Russia. So what does this do for the Jews? It brings with Napoleon is the great savior of the Jews. With each conquest, more and more Jews now have rights that they never had before. Jews would celebrate the arrival of Napoleon. Now, these rights came with kind of the clauses, whether explicit or implicit, of Clermont-Tonnay that we saw before. Yes, you can be a citizen, but citizenship means it's got to be France first, right? Citizenship means that you have to be one of us. No more of these your own judges, your own courts. Your allegiance has to be here. In fact, Napoleon famously brings together a group of rabbis. He calls them the Sanhedrin. And asks them a series of questions, forces them to respond to these questions, to put into writing that their first allegiance is going to be to France. So, 1810. 1810 comes as a result of three different things that were happening at the same time. Number one, you have the growth of this, what we call this move towards educational reform. That is, new intellectuals who are being influenced by the Enlightenment, who begin to look at things in a very different way, right, begin to try to do away with some of the superstition that had been involved, right, with the with what they saw as the old world of practice Judaism. Number two is that in this post French Revolutionary world, this post Enlightenment world, there is an emphasis in this world on aesthetics. Aesthetics become incredibly important. This is seen as a new world. In fact, the French wanted to start, there was actually a period in which they started counting from zero again, their years. That was how, to the degree to which they saw themselves as living in a new world. Right? The post-French Revolutionary world was unlike, this was a new enlightened world, unlike anything that had been before. And so with it came new sensitivities, new appreciations for aesthetics, things like a lack of decorum were things that were associated with that old, barbaric, right, pre-Enlightenment world. And by 1810, so you have Jews who have a millennial generation. Right? You have these young Jews who are growing up post-French Revolution. They were born in the 1790s. Now, by the first decade of the 19th century, they're in their teens. These are the kids that he's putting in his school. By 1810, and some of them are they're in their young 20s already. And they see the world differently. Their first language is German. Right? What is the great revolution? What is the great religion that emerges from one religion really remains intact, or to some degree seen as the enlightened religion, post-Enlightenment. Anybody know which one that is? Yes, Protestantism in general, right? Catholicism gets hit really hard, right? Certainly in Europe by the Enlightenment. It's seen as barbaric, it's seen as superstitious, whereas the Protestants are seen as sola scriptura, right? Just me and the Bible. There was a an enlightened element. It didn't have to go. We didn't rely on the priests to tell us what to think. We didn't have a pope who was infallible. Right? Those kinds of things Protestantism had done away with, and so it was seen as a much more enlightened religion. And so you have the Jews of the beginning of the 19th century, to whom that is the religion, right, that they look to as an enlightened religion. So there is a desire to look at their own religion and say, hey, this religion of Eastern Europe, of pre-French Revolution, pre-Enlightenment, doesn't speak to the kids today. You want to speak to somebody's soul? You want to uplift them? Well, you need music. You need a choir. These are the means by which people are inspired today. Hey, people aren't inspired by a rabbi speaking Yiddish at the front of the, you know, at a shtender in the front of the room. Hey, this is what it takes to speak to the heart of this generation. So there was educational reform. There is something we would refer to as aesthetic reform. And then there was a third element. Right? And that's what we would refer to as sort of the political piece of this, which is this desire, this newfound set of rights that they had, but which were hanging by a thread. By, yes, you can have rights in our society as long as you prove to us that you're really one of us. So what does it mean to be one of us?
Dress like us.
Speak like us.
Worship
like us. Who should we invite into this ceremony?
The councilmen,
the government officials, Christians, right? We want rapprochement with our Christian neighbors. That's what we're looking to create. That's what this new world, this new reality requires of us. Hence the emergence of this temple in Caesar. Now, the story obviously doesn't end there. What happens to Napoleon?
Defeated.
He gets defeated. He does indeed. Right? He attempts to conquer Russia. He gets turned back and chased back all the way to Paris. What happens to the Jews as a result?
Back in the ghettos.
Yes, indeed. All those newfound freedoms, gone a couple of years later. Now they've tasted it. So now you have a generation that has been there, has tasted it, knows what it looks like, and now has lost it. And now how do you think they were going to respond to that?
They want it back.
How am I going to get it back?
Prove myself.
Yeah. Yeah, to some degree, it's even more important now, right? That we prove to be, that we can be citizens of this new post-Napoleonic German state. And so the desire to some degree for emancipation, for those rights that they tasted for a brief few years becomes that much stronger. So what happens to Israel Jacobson? So the temple at Sisson ceases to exist after Napoleon is wiped back, and Jacobson moves to Berlin. In Berlin, he comes under the support of a wealthy philanthropist there who likes his ideas, who had heard about what he had done in Sisson. This philanthropist begins to start a prayer organization in Berlin that was going to mimic many of the same things that Jacobson had done in Sisson. This Berlin association gets underway and calls for several changes that Jacobson had already instituted in his synagogue. So amongst them were they were going to say certain prayers in German. They were going to wear the canonicals of the Protestant clergy. They were going to have an organ in the shul played on Shabbos by a non-Jew. They were going to shorten pieces of the davening. Why? For decorum purposes, right? Because davening's too long, and that's why we all talk, right? So if we can shorten it, right? So if we could shorten it, and the decorum would be better. This organization gets together, and on Shavuos, and I believe it was 1815, they open for the first time in a private person's house, and 400 people show up. Yes, a very, very large house. So much so that they decide that they actually need a second location in which to begin holding these this type of service. Leopold Zuns, who is a member of a different movement that we'll talk about in just a moment, attends a Yom Kippur davening in one of these places and said that this is his description: young people who have not attended a service in 20 years were inside the entire time. It was speaking to a generation, right, that had lost its connection, right, to the world of Judaism. And here, with these aesthetic reforms, right, came an opportunity for some of them to reconnect. As you can imagine, the religious establishments in Berlin were not terribly thrilled, right, by this development. They saw it as threatening. They saw it as changing, diverging from things that had always been done.
They haven't given up mitzvahs.
Huh?
They haven't given up mitzvahs.
No, not at all. Not at all. Everything up until this point had been largely aesthetic, right? In its in terms of the changes that have been made. And so the rabbinic establishment in So the rabbinic establishment in Berlin begins to actually goes to the Prussian government and argues that these synagogues are illegal, because they were not sanctioned but through the official organs of the Jewish community. The leaders of this group then go out and seek rabbinic tshuvot to defend what they are doing. Two people are murdered, one by the name of Eliezer Lieberman, who becomes a critical name in this whole process, but who nobody had ever really heard of before. But the more important player in this was a man by the name of Aaron Chorin, who was an established rabbi in Austro-Hungary at the time, who was pretty well respected, who begins to write tshuvot for each and every one of the changes that they have made and defend them on halakhic grounds. The rabbinic establishment in Berlin responds by writing to the major rabbanim of Western and Central Europe at the time, asking them to write tshuvot, proving that in fact this was not okay. People like Rabbi Akiva Eger, Rabbi Akiva Eger's son-in-law, Rav Moshe Sofer, otherwise known as the Chassam Sofer, right? These are the people who begin to get involved in writing these tshuvot against what they were doing. And then comes Eliezer Lieberman again and collects a whole variety of tshuvot, that amazing things that begin to get that begin to surface. Italian rabbanim writing about organs that were played years ago in Prague on Shabbos by non-Jews, finding precedent for some of the things that they had done. That piece was published in a compendium known as Noga HaTzedek, The Splendor of Righteousness, published by this guy Eliezer Lieberman, and again trying to defend the Berlin Temple Association in the reforms that it was making. The Berlin Temple Association never gets very far. By 1823, the government shuts them down completely. The Prussian government didn't like them, actually, at all. The Prussian government was very conservative by nature. Again, this is a reactionary government to Napoleon. And so now, where Napoleon was opening everything up, these governments want to tighten things down. They also were afraid, perhaps, that this would be, you know, this would lead to a more attractive Judaism, which perhaps is something the Prussian government wasn't looking for, perhaps. But it doesn't work. It doesn't work there. But at the very same time, a man by the name of Edward Clay, who was a preacher in Jacobson's temple in Seesen, leaves Berlin and goes to Hamburg. In Hamburg, he starts a school. The school needs a shul. And so he decides, in 1818, he is going to start a a new temple, a new Israelite temple association in Hamburg, on the top of page 6. Since public worship has for some time been neglected by so many, because of the ever-decreasing knowledge of the language in which alone it has until now been conducted, and also because of many other shortcomings which have crept in at the same time, the undersigned, convinced of the necessity to restore public worship to its deserving dignity and importance, have joined together to follow the example of several Israelite congregations, especially the one in Berlin. They plan to arrange in this city also, for themselves as well as others who think as they do, a dignified and well-ordered ritual according to which the worship service shall be conducted on the Sabbath and holy days and on other solemn occasions, and which shall be observed in their own temple, to be erected especially for this purpose. Specifically, there shall be introduced at such services a German sermon and choral singing to the accompaniment of an organ, again, including on Shabbos, played by a non-Jew. Incidentally, the above-mentioned ritual shall not be confined to services in the temple. Rather, it shall apply to all those religious customs and acts of daily life which are sanctified by the church or by their own nature. Outstanding amongst these are the entrance of the newly born into the covenant of the fathers, weddings, and the like. Also, a religious ceremony shall be introduced in which the children of both sexes, after having received adequate schooling in the teachings of their faith, shall be accepted as confirmation of the Mosaic religion. This was the emergence of the Hamburg Temple in 1817, ultimately 1818. What emerges as a result is one of the great disputes of 19th century Jewish community, what is known as the Hamburg Temple controversy. The responses to this are what we're going to discuss in our talk on the emergence of ultra-Orthodoxy. Suffice it to say, this one ultimately takes root. And the Hamburg Temple does, in fact, open. It opens with its own sitter, a sitter that takes out any references to Shivat Zion, to Jews going back to the land of Israel. Why? I mean, if I'm going to win back emancipation and citizenship for Jews, I can't stand up 3 times a day and say, God, take me back to Israel. Right? That doesn't work very well. So those things had to be taken out. They had a German sermon. There were certain prayers that were going to be done in German as well. There was going to be, they went back to the triennial cycle of Torah reading. Right, which was the old, old custom in Israel that ultimately I think lands up in Alexandria, was not the accepted. Now, why would they do that? Why would they go back to the triennial?
It's shorter,
exactly. Right, and allows for more decorum. to make a long story short, though, it was vehemently opposed, but that opposition did not make headway. In fact, this organization was then copied in several other places in Western Europe over the coming decades. Now, what happens over the next few decades, I will summarize for you quickly, but it's important to see how the story evolves. 1819, a series of riots break out in Western Europe, known as the Hep-Hep Riots. The Hep-Hep Riots do very little to the physical safety of the Jewish community, but they do a lot to the psychological safety of the Jewish community. That is a group which, again, felt like they were on the cusp of emancipation, of being accepted by their society, now it finds people rioting in the streets against them, specifically against the Jews, feel like they have much more ground to make up than they thought they did before. At the same time, by the time we get to the 1820s and 1830s, another movement is emerging, known as the movement for Wissenschaft des Judentums. Wissenschaft des Judentums means the scientific study of Judaism. Again, we're in a post-Enlightenment world. The Enlightenment brings in this idea that things can be studied in a scientific way. We now have Jews by the 1820s and 1830s who have grown up and born. The only world that they know is a post-Enlightenment world. They begin to study. They begin to study at universities. They begin to subject their Jewish belief, their Jewish text, to scientific, historical examination and analysis. Critical amongst those people was a man by the name of Abraham Geiger, who emerges as a leader of these newly reformed type of organizations. The top of page 7. The Talmud and the Bible, too, that collection of books, most of them so splendid and uplifting, perhaps the most exalting of all literature of human authorship, can no longer be viewed as of divine origin. Right? He's a historian, Geiger is. He is telling you by his scientific historical analysis, these books, they're not divine. They're written by human beings. They're beautiful, but they're written by human beings. Of course, all this will not come to pass today or even tomorrow, but it should be our goal. We're in 1836, and will continue to be so. In this fashion, we are working closely with every true endeavor and movement of our day, and we will accomplish more by study than we could by means of 100 sermons and widespread religious instruction. For the love of heaven, how much longer can we continue this deceit to expound the stories of the Bible from the pulpits over and over again as actual historical happenings? To accept as supernatural events of world import stories which we ourselves have relegated to the realm of legend, and to derive teachings from them, or at least to use them as the basis for sermon and texts? How much longer will we continue to perfect the spirit of a child with these tales that distort the natural good sense of tender youth? But how can this be changed? By driving such falsehoods into a corner, of course. By clearly revealing this paradox to both ourselves and to others. By pursuing into their secret hiding places all those who could seek to evade the issue, and thus eventually helping to open a new world for us in its place. Geiger then comes armed with historical evidence, with critical analysis, scientific critical analysis, gets combined with the movement for educational reform and aesthetic reform and the move for political emancipation, and comes Geiger and says, you know what? These texts aren't even off. There's the authority claimed by the rabbis isn't authentic. Right? What people are saying came from God didn't. They came from human beings, and we have the right to continue to change them in ways that people always did. And so these come together by the 1840s. This is Geiger, who is the impetus for a series of conferences in which leaders of these types of synagogues, of these types of places that had up until this point continued to try and justify what they were doing on halakhic grounds, come together in the 1840s and say it's time to adopt some sort of ideology. What is it? Who are we? What is it that we're trying to say? And so they raise several questions, right, that sort of get to the heart of who they are and adopt answers as a result. So one question that comes up at the Reform Rabbinical Conference of Frankfurt in 1845 is the question of Mashiach and how they were going to view this concept. So looking at the second paragraph, right, but now our concepts have changed. There is no need anymore for an extended ceremonial law. The earlier approach restricted divine guidance to the land of Israel and the people. The deity, it was believed, enjoyed bloody sacrifices, and priests were needed for penance. With increasing zeal, the prophets spoke up against this restricted view. The prophets, the Nevi'im themselves, says these rabbis, spoke up against the burdening of the people with ceremonial law, right? What did they say? They said God really wants is tzedek u'mishpat, right? Is to be righteous and just, right? He doesn't want more karbanos. He wants us to do the right thing, and they take that as a proof text that, in fact, that's what this law, that's what Judaism was intended to be. So the resolution at the very end, look at that last underlined line, right? Only the Talmud moves in circles. We, however, favor progress. Right? And so the resolution adopted by the majority is that the messianic idea should receive prominent mention in the prayers, but all petitions for our return to the land of our fathers and for the restoration of a Jewish state should be eliminated from the liturgy. So here we have it. Right? By the 1840s, we have now for the first time this group now coming together and saying, you know what, no, the religious law which had guided us up until this point is not binding on us. For all the historical reasons that they could muster, right, that in fact this wasn't the authentic way in which Judaism had intended to be practiced. It's something that crept in over the generations in a pre-Enlightenment world. Now we are in an Enlightened world, and we can and ought to adjust this in order to fit our concept of what Enlightened religion is supposed to be. This question.
Yeah, so how did Geiger conclude that the Bible is not divine? Like, where is he coming from to say that? Because I assume he had a traditional yeshiva upbringing as well, along with a lot of other people.
Geiger did not. Geiger is born post French Revolution. There's one in Altenau, Hamburg, but very little.
But even so, like, things like the documentary hypothesis haven't come about yet for him to point to that and say it's not divine. So based off what is he coming?
Okay, people, but people like Spinoza have been around for a while already, so it's likely Spinoza's initial influence. And you're right, the documentary hypothesis comes about in the late 19th century, but the idea that it was humanly authored well precedes Wellhausen and those of the late 19th century. But it's a good point. Okay, so that's our process, right? From the early educational aesthetic reforms by the middle of the 19th century, which, keep in mind, by 1845, Jews of Germany still do not have rights. They won't have them until the late 1860s and someplace in the 1870s elsewhere. Right? So this whole century, it is marred by a discord between Enlightenment ideas everywhere around them and a reality on the ground, which is a Jew does not have rights. And a Jew cannot go into court. A Jew is barred from certain religions, can't own certain things. And that discord is very much at the heart of some of this. The other piece of it is this idea that it just wasn't speaking to the people, to the generation that is growing up in this brave new world. Yeah.
So these were like the Chachamim making these decisions, but what were the people actually doing? Were they practicing still Halachic Judaism?
So we're gonna look at that. Not next time, but in two times from now. That's an excellent question. Right? Now, also, these are not the mainstream establishment rabbinic leaders either. Right? These are the rabbis of these new temple associations that had sprung up that are now coming together. But there's quite a bit of opposition, which is, again, what we're going to look at next time. I just want to point out that
these guys are still very much fringe, right?
They are. Yeah. They are. Absolutely. Without a doubt. Fringe, but now by the 1840s, they need to be contended with. Right, to the fringe, to the point, but so nobody's ignoring them anymore. Right, by the 1840s,
congregants are going to university though. I think they're not citizens, but
they are allowed into university. Yes. okay. There is a parallel process that is happening. This is happening in Germany, right, over the course of the 19th century. There is a parallel process that is happening in the United States at the very same time. So I gave you a paragraph that you can find on the website of. A Reform synagogue today in Charleston, South Carolina, the Kal Kadosh Beth Elohim. Question?
Just before you leave Europe, if the Enlightenment had its greatest expression in France, why is it that Reform Judaism took root in Germany?
Because the Enlightenment had its, well, many, but the late Enlightenment actually had its roots in Germany. People like Kant, right, and Mendelssohn were actually most active in and around Berlin, much more
sure,
so than France.
Politically, it was.
Politically, it was France, but intellectually, it was actually by the late Enlightenment, much more in Germany. Okay, but it is interesting, by the way, that France never develops a Reformed community, mm-hmm. right? And part of that, though, is because those Jews retained their rights. Right? French Jewry continue to be emancipated. They never lose it, right? In France proper. Right? It's in Germany where they did lose it, right? that this movement emerges. Okay, so from the website of Kal Kadosh Beth Elohim, I'm going to read to you their description, and now that you've been educated about the rise of Reform, you'll identify certain things in this paragraph that will strike you as extremely familiar. Right? So Charleston is acknowledged as the birthplace of Reformed Judaism in the United States. In 1824, so that is 5 years after the Hamburg Temple controversy, or 7 years after it was first proposed, 47 congregants petitioned the Adjunta of the synagogue to change the Sephardic Orthodox liturgy. I forgot to mention this. One of the other things that Jacobson did was initially bring in the Sephardic pronunciation, Sfaradit, as opposed to Ashkenazis, which is part of that same move away from the pre-Enlightenment world of Judaism. And they saw the Sephardic community, particularly the Sephardic French community, as a more enlightened group and adopted their Havara, their pronunciation, which they did in Berlin, which they did in Hamburg as well. And as you can see, they did in Charleston as well. The petition, which asked for the abridgment of the Hebrew ritual, so making it shorter, English translation of the prayers, and a sermon in English, was denied. The disappointed liberal members thereupon resigned from the congregation and organized the Reformed Society of Israelites. This independent society, led by Isaac Harbi and Abraham Moitz, was influenced by the ideas of the Hamburg Reformed Congregation, the leading modernist community in Europe. It lasted only 9 years, but many of its practices and principles have become part of today's Reformed Judaism. The progressives rejoined the old congregation, and while the present temple was being built in 1840, an organ was installed. As well as the organ, the first service in the new temple introduced a liberalized ritual. KKBE was one of the founding synagogues of the Union of American Hebrew Congregations in 1873 and remains firmly and proudly committed to Reform Judaism. By 1885, the center of Reform Judaism shifts from Germany to the United States with the adoption of the Pittsburgh Platform in 1885. We'll read numbers 3, 4, and 5, and with that we'll end. Number 3 of the Pittsburgh Platform, 1885. We recognize in the Mosaic legislation a system of training the Jewish people for its mission during its national life in Palestine. And today, we accept as binding only its moral laws and maintain only such ceremonies as elevate and sanctify our lives, but reject all such as are not adapted to the views and habits of modern civilization. Mosaic legislation belonged to a time and place. That's the Wissenschaft element. That's the historians, right, who emerge in the 19th century, Geiger and those who follow. It belonged to a certain time and place. It doesn't belong to our time and place. The moral ideas behind it continue to ring true today as much as they ever did. We hold that all such Mosaic and rabbinical laws as regulate diet, priestly purity, and dress originated in ages and under the influence of ideas entirely foreign to our present mental and spiritual state. It doesn't speak to Jews anymore today. They fail to impress the modern Jew with the spirit of priestly holiness. Their observance in our days is apt rather to obstruct than to further modern spiritual elevation. And again, I can't express enough that this is a genuine desire for spiritual elevation, for spiritual connection in a world that simply didn't see itself able to connect in the ways that previous generations did. And number 5, we recognize in the modern era of universal culture of heart and intellect, the approaching of the realization of Israel's great messianic hope for the establishment of the kingdom of truth, justice, and peace among all men. We consider ourselves no longer a nation. You hear Clermont-Tonnay from the 18th century, right? We consider ourselves no longer a nation, but a religious community, and therefore expect neither a return to Palestine, nor a sacrificial worship under the sons of Aaron, nor the restoration of any of the laws concerning the Jewish state. So the ideas that were there right from the outset in the late 18th and the early 19th century become crystallized with the adoption of the Pittsburgh Platform in 1885. Now again, this story is a lot more complicated in that it didn't go without opposition. The opposition was vociferous. The opposition leads to the development in and of itself of new elements to other facets of Judaism, and that's a story we'll pick up with next time. Thank you.